Starting on slide number 2, so I got that going all right. This is a very heterogeneous group. We have geeks in here. And yes, these are the characters that are rather odd looking and have pocket protectors and so forth.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. We also have beginners, you know, people who struggle to find the button to push to get the computer started. And the challenge for anybody speaking to this group is to try and mingle these things and hopefully not put one group or the other to sleep too long. That's an obvious challenge. I want to start with backup and restore. This has been talked about any number of times. This is slide number 3. And the reason is this is very critically important. Just remember when that disk drive is spinning in your computer at 7,200 RPMs, just a few thousandths of an inch above that platter is a head that's reading it, and if it touches that platter, your data is gone. And sooner or later, somebody will experience disk drive failures. Hence, the reason to do a backup. Now, there are two kinds of people who do backup. Those who do, and those who will. I am assuming the majority of people are using Windows 7 at this point.
Four.
Number 4, thank you. The reason being, according to what I've been reading in various statistics, Windows 7 is now the dominant Windows operating system that's currently in use. Windows 8 is probably coming out late next year. But I will emphasize Windows 7 throughout the talk. Windows 7 itself comes with a very good backup and restore facility. Unlike earlier versions of Windows where the backup and restore was pretty iffy, this is really quite good. I've used it since it came out, and fortunately I've not had to bring back a whole system, but I have rescued files that I've lost for one reason or another. There are three components to it. One is called user's data. This does not back up the programs or the operating system, but it backs up all of the user's data, photos, documents, email, whatever you've got in your user folders. You can also create a system image. That is, copy everything that's on the platter to another device, typically an external disk drive. And you can also create a bootable system recovery disk so that if your disk gets blown away internally, you can boot up from the recovery disk and then bring everything back, either from the image or from the backup files itself. And if you want more information, all these informational icons, as I said earlier, are hot-linked. And here's Microsoft, a video on their backup and restore, and a lot of other information about it.
Warren, may I ask?
Yeah.
When it says it backs up users' data,
yeah.
Is that if you store it the way Windows likes you to store it?
Yes.
So as long as you put stuff in My Documents, it's probably going to be backed up.
But yes. No. There are kind of two modes, in a sense, for doing this. One is allow Windows to pick itself, and it'll do everything. All you have to do is click this box, which then does everything in documents. However, you also have the option to click on down to fine detail what you want to have backed up. So you could include something if you put on another disk drive.
Thank you.
Sure. Slide number 5, for those of you who are Mac enthusiasts, a piece of software called Time Machine comes with the current and earlier operating systems, Mac OSs, and this does a very good job of backup. Apple also sells a piece of hardware called Time Capsule, which uses Time Machine software, but Time Capsule itself is a wireless or a wired backup device. It acts like a disk drive, and this is very similar to Microsoft's backup. The difference is, as usual, with the Macintosh, has a lot more eye candy, and it's somewhat more user-friendly. But functionally, they're almost identical. On slide 6, many of you use Acronis True Image for backup. It's very popular. It works well. It does disk imaging. It does file backups, both full differential and incremental backups. And it's priced at least what is advertised from about $40 on up. Bargains can be had for this. It's a very good backup system. Yes?
A question on sort of built-in suspenders. If you pick one of these approaches, either what's built into Microsoft or Acronis, do you trust it enough that that's really going to be reliable, or do you do backups in multiple ways?
Depends on how paranoid you are.
How paranoid are you?
Yeah, I'm fairly paranoid. And I'll explain in a minute about that. Let me go on. I'll address that point a little bit more. Slide number 7. There are other backup schemes. If you look in Wikipedia, there are listed 17 free backup utilities for Windows that you can take your pick from. Also, another thing that is now becoming of fair interest is backup on the cloud. Well, the cloud is not new. I mean, it just has a new name in a sense. If you look in Wikipedia, there's 37 different offerings for cloud backup. And there was a very good article in PC World on cloud backup. I did an estimate of what it would cost for me to back up to Amazon S3, which is one of the offerings. Since I have nearly a terabyte of data, it would cost about $150 a month for me to back up there. So unless you have a relatively small amount, the prices for doing backup on the cloud are pretty substantial. So I'm not going to be doing this. I'm not going to pay $150 a month. I could buy an external disk drive each month and throw it away and still make money. Slide 8. You may also want to consider, if you're going to get a new computer in the not-too-distant future, to get one with RAID 1. RAID 1 means that in the box, the computer box itself, there'll be two disk platters instead of one, two disk drives, and they are mirror images, one of another. That means if one fails, all you have to do is shut down the computer, take out the failed drive, put in a new drive, boot it up, and in 2 or 3 hours, you'll be back to right where you were. However, this is not a substitute for other backup. The reason being is if your disaster is caused by a virus, you have a duplicate virus. You can't get rid of it. I mean, you're just copying back what you had before. But in the case of mechanical failure, it works very well. Now, being a belt and suspenders man, I use RAID 1, and I have a backup to another server. So that's my extent of paranoia. I don't trust just one by any means. Apple, Dell, and HP all have RAID 1 offerings on their computers, and I'm sure other manufacturers do as well. RAID can get very complex, and if you want more information on it, here's a link to it. There's RAID level 0, 1, on up through, I think, 7. I've even seen 10, I believe. So that's a whole lecture in and of itself. Windows Home Server, which you see right down here at the bottom, is another scheme you can use for backup, and one which I've used for about 4 or 5 years. This has never been a very commercial success for either Microsoft or the hardware manufacturers. Windows Home Server is essentially software as well as a server which sits on your home network, and it does automatic backup, and it does a lot of other things as well. It does it very automatically, although you can't just trust and be sure. You have to be sure things are really working, and I'll explain later. But that's another option that's open to you. There are various backup utilities for Linux, and Jeff, I think these probably come from Unix, so many of them, and are Unix derivatives. But here are a listing of a half a dozen of them. Now remember, you need to monitor backup and to assure yourself it's working. Yes, thank you. We're now on slide number 10. The reason being is it can very silently do nothing and not back up anything, and you may not be aware of it until you have a disaster. So you have to keep your eye on this thing. And you should also periodically test and bring back some files that you thought were backed up. You don't have to do a whole lot there, but every once in a while, remind yourself to pull a file back to be sure and have some comfort level. Backup is not a set and forget function. I don't care what these vendors say, just set it and forget it. You must not do that, because Murphy lives, and you know what's going to happen if you don't test it. Now, how paranoid are you? Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody isn't out to get you.
Yes.
Slide number 11. This is related to backup because these days the best way to backup is to an external disk drive. The disk drives are in general reliable enough, and they're certainly cheap enough. So if your backup disk drive fails, it's no big loss. You don't have to take out a second mortgage to buy another one. A 500 gigabyte drive is now nominally $75. These figures are the average of about 10 prices that I've seen on the web. So you can now buy a 3 terabyte drive for $167, and the price for storage in that case is about 5 cents a gigabyte, which is unbelievable. Now, a slight digression here about the price of disk drives.
Slide 12.
Thank you, slide 12. In 1979, when I was still working, I bought a 75 megabyte disk drive, $12,500. That will hold about 25 pictures from your camera today. In today's money, that's a little over $37,000. And the cost of storage is $598 per megabyte. And that's just 32 years ago. Today, as I've already mentioned, you can buy a 3 terabyte disk drive for $167, which is a fraction of a cent per megabyte for storage. Now, that's a drop of almost 9 million to 1 in 32 years. I don't know of anything in human history that's dropped like that, except maybe computer memory parallels it. This is very hard to wrap your head around. I mean, what does 9 million to 1 mean? Well, now on slide 13. Here's a real neat, spiffy, expensive Mercedes sports car that sells for $207,000. If automotive technology had kept up with the price of disk drives, that car would cost 2.3 cents, or five for a dime. That puts it in more understandable terms. That's slide 13. On slide 14.
Quick question on drives. Some drives, when you have too much capacity, are they as reliable? Is there a reliability factor in
I don't think so. There probably is more of a reliability factor on the type of drive you buy more than just the capacity in and of itself. In a certain sense, you get what you pay for. Some drives which cost more than others are probably more reliable and some are more efficient, green drives, for example, which shut themselves off. Now, whether that adds or detracts from reliability, I'm not sure. There's a lot of controversy over the mean time to failure of disk drives, and I keep reading about it and keep not understanding what's going on here. But drives really will last for quite a few years. It's just that a drive is more likely to fail in the first few months you buy it, and then after 3 or 4 or 5 years old, the failure rate goes up. So I'm not don't quite answer your question, but I'll waffle around it a bit for you.
One question on backup. For example, I have a couple of external disk drives that I use for backup, but I also copy files from my regular hard drive to the external hard drives. Is there any reason why one should use backup rather than just simply copying files from one drive to another?
There's no reason you can't do both. And the files you use from backup through any particular software have a different file format entirely than what you were copying manually and just drop and drag and drop. Mm-hmm. But there's no problem you putting both on the same device. Eventually you're going to fill it up, so you have to keep an eye on the capacity of the drive and how full it's getting. Yes, Neil?
Because I don't take pictures, the amount of computer files I have at home is not all that much. One DVD will hold everything I have as zip files. I do a zip file compression, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so I make two DVDs once a month. And the two DVDs are identical because I'm assuming, ha, 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 this is my question. How much space do you have and your whole backup is two DVDs and, oh, yes, a third copy on a 500 gigabyte hard drive? That's my backup scheme.
Well, since you don't have a lot of data, that's fine, but I have a terabyte and I can't back it up to DVDs and still get anything else done in life.
That's for sure. But is two DVDs, they sit in the bank vault. Because I figure if your problem is that you have a fire at home or the part of your house where your computer is, you know, that extra in your home does not help you.
That's right.
So I sort of like the idea that my bank is about 10 miles away. I picked it on purpose.
Yeah.
I did not look for the Bank of America branch closest to my front door. I thought I wanted 10 miles of separation. But anyway, is two DVDs considered safe?
I don't know how anybody can answer that question. It depends on your level of paranoia. Yeah.
Question on hard drives and failures. What do you think of the smart technology that will signal incipient failures?
Yeah.
Have you had any experience with that?
I have when I was working. We used EMC drives, which were very expensive at that time. Although, if you have disk drives in a commercial setting, they are not the same price as you get that we're using. And they do have software that senses sectors that fail and spots in the drive that fail and can predict failure coming.
Well, I've seen that on a drive in my PC, and Norton software started flashing a red light at me, saying you're about to have a problem.
Yeah.
But I just wondered whether you used that and trusted it.
I haven't used it. I would be inclined, if I had software that's giving me that kind of message, to be noteful of it and replace the drive. I mean, the drives are not that expensive.
Oh, I did. It was years ago.
Yeah. Rebuilding a system, even with good backup, is emotionally painful. Okay, let me go on to antivirus software. Again, this is another one of these things. Two kind of people who are going to use it, those who do and those who will. It parallels the issue with backup. And if one is not careful, you're going to get infected. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's all kinds of nasty stuff out there. One way to avoid it is not go on the Internet at any time or copy a file from anybody at any time, which, of course, is impractical. Now, on slide 15... there's a lot of antivirus, anti-malware software out there. I've used Microsoft Security Essentials since it came out, and I've found it to be excellent. It's very easy to set up. It's very easy to keep track of it. You can set it so it'll do a full scan of your system on any particular day and hour, or every day if you wish. And in surfing around on the web, I haven't found any complaints about it. I suspect if this did not work well, the web would be filled with complaints because it's Microsoft. I've been very pleased with it, and it's free. Malwarebytes is a nice piece of software that checks for malware on your system. It's easy to use. And Super Anti-Spyware is another one, although they have two versions, one free and one for pay. These latter two are not antiviral detectors. They are checking for cookies and other things people can deposit on your computer. This is a list of free antivirus software: Avast, AVG, Avira, Komodo, Panda. The paid products came into being because initially Microsoft didn't offer any antivirus protection whatsoever. So there was a market there for it, and a number of these companies sprang up. Norton and McAfee typically trade first place honors for the paid software. These products tend to be more sophisticated than the offerings that are free. And they'll do other things besides just antivirus. Kaspersky, AVG, and Zone Alarm are others that are very popular. And here are some more. These are all paid products. Now on slide 19, those without backup and antivirus software are skating on thin ice. Slide 20. Now, there are a number of security utilities available, various types. Password management is one that's very handy. This has been talked about endlessly. We all now have a large number of passwords to keep track of. If you have one password that you use for everything, you're really looking for trouble. The alternative is to have these on little bits of paper scattered around the house, which are hard to keep track of. So I would suggest getting one of these password management. RoboForm is very popular. I know in this crowd quite a number of people use it. I've used it for a number of years. Password Genie is another one, which is quite good. And there's a good review in Smart Computing this last May. LastPass, Password Safe, and KeePass are all free, and they are quite good. Yes?
Does RoboFarm require an annual update?
No. It isn't quite forever. What happens every few years, they'll issue a new upscale version, and you'll kind of be forced to buy it.
You can get it. Once you buy it, you don't pay $29 anymore. You pay $19.
Yeah.
And that's good for
several years.
One computer. But you can get it. You can get the version that will go on a thumb drive. And you can use that.
Yes.
On any machine.
Yeah. Yeah. You can go to this link for RoboForm, and there's several products that they offer there, and see what you would like. Yeah, Gabe.
Do you know whether RoboForm will import passwords? I've been saving passwords in Firefox and letting it be the password manager. Do you know whether any of them will import the password database that you built up?
Yeah, I don't know. IronKey, the last one on the list here, is interesting. This is an encrypted thumb drive, a flash drive, and they're really quite expensive. I think this company is appealing to big commercial companies more than anything. I'm not sure why any of us would want to do this when you can buy software which you can encrypt everything you can put on a thumb drive virtually for free, except for $4 or $5 with a thumb drive. But such devices like this are available, and they're probably fairly widely used in the commercial environment. Now, on slide 21, there are a number of password checkers that are available. If you're going to encrypt data on your PC or you're going to use a password management system, you have to have one good password. And Rankin.com offers a very nice service here where you can put in a test password and get some idea of its strength. In this case, they say it's a reasonably strong password. It's 12 characters long. And it has a certain entropy value. The higher the entropy value means the more random it is. Think of a teenager's bedroom. You know, the mess all over the floor, that's high entropy. And the whole universe trends towards high entropy. And the more entropy it is, the more difficult it is to randomly guess what it is. On slide 22, Microsoft has a password checker as well. It doesn't give you quite as much information, but it tells you whether it's weak, not so bad, okay, or the best one to use. On slide 23, a company called Gibson Research Corporation has an interesting site. And here, which of these two passwords is the strongest one? Well, you know you're being set up here, aren't you? Is it the D0G followed by, I think it's 21 periods, or this forgettable one below it? Well, the answer is it's the D0G one. And I'll show you why. Here's the very complex one. And if you notice at the bottom, just kind of remember that number for a minute. Essentially 9 billion trillion centuries would be required to decipher that password. That's assuming that the machine you're using does 100 trillion guesses per second. So it's going to take a long time for somebody to just crack that password. On the other hand, this one is 900 billion trillion centuries of time to take. That is 100 times more secure than the previous one. That's assuming, of course, there's a random attack on the password. If you use 23 characters of just plain English words, all the bets are off. These have to be random in order to get these kinds of numbers. Yeah.
You would remember, but that's normal English, but you have a capital.
You know what you can do? Something. I'll tell you something similar to what I do. I can say, My uncle was an idiot born in 1942. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not likely somebody's going to guess that consequence, but that's not really a random pattern either. So it's kind of a compromise between being able to remember something and having something really random, which is hard to guess. Okay, now, on slide 27, I'm going to run out of time pretty soon, aren't I? About halfway through, right? Okay. Now, occasionally you're going to find your email address has been compromised. This happens not terribly frequently, but it does happen. Somebody breaks into a Sony PlayStation, or in Sony, for example, and downloads a few million email addresses and passwords. This sort of thing happens every once in a while. This is a site where you can check to see if your email address has been compromised. Gmail, for example, has an activity log which you can examine and see when you or somebody else accessed your Gmail. If you, for example, if you didn't use your Gmail account last 2 days, you can log on and look, and if you see there have been 200 times somebody has accessed your email, you know you're in trouble, and the least you have to do is change the password. So that's a very useful thing to do. I don't know if Verizon and Yahoo offer these activity logs. I did a quick look and didn't find them. Does anybody know whether you can with these two? Yeah. But Gmail offers this very nicely. And should I change my password.com, looks like this. And you put in your email address and click check it, and it comes back with a message, yes, it's been compromised, or no, it hasn't. Now, how do they do this? When an organization vandalizes somebody's website, they typically publish all this stuff. For example, when the Sony was broken into recently and they downloaded, I don't know, 2 million email addresses and passwords, they made that publicly available. This company takes that publicly available information, hashes it, puts it on their website, on their servers, and then when you put in your email address, it hashes it and checks their hashed or encoded, that is, in ciphered database. And if they find it, they tell you. So that way, they are not storing unencrypted data. They encrypt yours coming in. And they provide a very nice service. So I would suggest you use this website and check your email address once in a while to see if it's been hacked. Yes? Yeah.
And LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn is
well, there's an organization called LutzSync, which is rather notorious, and there's a link to this on here. This is an organization which is an organization of hackers that gets into any number of sites. They've hacked DoD, for example, HP, telephone companies, and then they publish all the data. It's kind of a WikiLeaks sort of an operation. A number of the people who have been involved with this have been arrested in England. This site, which I just clicked to, you'll find quite interesting reading. And this is the sort of thing where this company I just mentioned gets their data from. And it's just kind of fascinating to see the nastiness that's going on here. Yeah, Gabe.
Specifically with LinkedIn, where somebody, a friend, imported her address book because she thought she would selectively invite people to connect with her on LinkedIn, and either she made a mistake or LinkedIn did, but it invited everybody in her address book to connect, including old boyfriends, bosses who had fired her, and stores that she was communicating with and happened to have her email address. So firewalls between contexts, between LinkedIn, where you can one at a time, or Facebook, where you can one at a time connect, and your whole address book. Firewalls are very good for protection.
Yeah,
but firewall won't protect against
Okay, slide 29. Now, what happens when a file is deleted? We've gone through this before in different venues. When you delete a file on your PC, it goes into the recycle bin, and it's very easy to recover it, which is both good and bad. When you empty the recycle bin, there are two files that are marked deleted. One is called the master file table, MFT, and it just says this file with all the information on it, where it's stored on the disk, has been deleted. The other file is called $bitmap, which is a bitmap of your whole disk drive, and it is typically broken into 4 kilobyte sections, and it marks this has been deleted. You notice I didn't say your data have been deleted. It's still there. And it stays there until these segments are reused by other programs. So a hacker can very easily get at this stuff. Now, again, depending on how paranoid you are, there's a free product called Eraser, which instead of just deleting a file from your disk drive, if you apply Eraser to it, it not only deletes it in the traditional way, it goes to those sectors on the disk drives and writes random characters to it. Yes? Yeah, theoretically, but I don't think you can entirely trust it. What Erase does is it uses standards set up by the various military organizations in terms of the randomness that they write to it and how many times it is written. It can take a long time to erase a big file. There's no DoD standard for this. There's an Army standard, a Navy standard, an Air Force standard, and so on and so forth. And the same with the Brits. They have different military standards, and the Germans have military standards. But Eraser allows you to pick which one you want to use and how many times you want to apply it. So depending on how much patience you have to truly erase a file and how paranoid you are, you have your choice. But this really works very well. On slide 31, there is a free product called CC Cleaner, which will do much the same thing. It completely removes unused files. It'll go through your whole disk drive and examine files that have been erased, that is the dollar bitmap, and go through and write random characters to it. This can take quite a long time. So you may want to apply this before you go to bed at night, and your disk drive will be cleaned up by morning. And it has an uninstaller and a registry cleaner. Be careful of registry cleaners. So this can be another way to really clean up your act, so to speak. If you don't apply CC Cleaner, you can use Recova, which is made by the same company, to recover files which you have deleted and eliminated from your recycle bin. So it goes out onto the disk drive, finds this stuff, and brings it back for you. Now, if you're trying to bring back something you erased 6 months ago, chances are you're not going to get it back again. Or if you've applied some program to clean up your disk drive, you can't get it back. But this can be a useful utility for something you've erased, let's say, 2 or 3 days ago, and you're saying, oh my gosh. But remember, the best way to get that back is from your backup rather than trying to recover it from the drive. Okay, slide 33. Adaware is a really nice utility. It's billed as a spyware and malware killer. That's kind of an overstatement, perhaps. It seems to protect well against rootkits, which are really nasty things that can wind up on your computer. Rootkits come from Unix, where somebody had root privileges, was able to do anything on the computer. That's the source of the word root. These typically are very destructive pieces of software that are hard to detect. Adaware seems to be, I haven't had it detect any. I haven't, fortunately, not had any root kits deposited, but the literature shows that it works pretty well. This is not an antivirus program. This is something that cleans up cookies, for example, that look particularly pernicious. On slide 34, this is a very fine utility. I know a number of people here that use it. Secunia PSI, Personal Software Inspector. What this does is it goes through your computer and looks at all the programs you have, and it gives you a table which shows you which, if you have something that's out of date and there's a more recent version, it tells you. It provides a link so you can go get it. So not only does it tell you if a program you have is out of date, you can do a 1 or 2 clicks and update the program itself. It does this for both programs and plugins that you use in your browser. It's a very good product. They also sell a commercial version of this which does more, but the free one really does a very good job. It does fail once in a while in the sense, for example, I've noticed lately it's telling me I have an old version of Google browser, Chrome, on my computer, and I don't. I have the most recent version. So it isn't 100%, but it's pretty close to it. There's a product called Panda USB Vaccine, which will disable auto-run features, either on the computer or on USB drives and other devices. Now, what does this mean? If you find a USB drive, a thumb drive, laying there on the sidewalk, you don't want to pick it up and plug it in your computer. Because invariably what has happened, somebody's put something really nasty on there and it'll auto-run. You plug it in and it runs. And what it does is then copy the nasty stuff from the thumb drive to your computer and it's infected. This will allow you to have a USB port that turns off the auto-run feature. So if you plug in a USB drive you got from somebody, it will not let auto-run run. In any case, if you find the thumb drive laying on the sidewalk, ignore it. But
what your mom say? You don't know where that's been.
Yeah, But it is also conceivable somebody can give you a USB drive, all innocence, giving you a file, but they're giving you a social disease on there as well. So be careful.
Remember the dog ate your homework and maybe it passed through the...
File encryption. We've talked about this before too. This is actually very easy to implement now. If you have any kind of personal information on your computer, it's really wise to encrypt it, and it's easy to do. TrueCrypt is free. You can download it from this website here. It takes maybe 5 minutes to implement it. What TrueCrypt does is it creates a virtual disk drive on your hard drive. So you have a K drive, for example, that's created. And anything you put on that drive is encrypted. So you can put pictures in there, Word documents, anything that you have on your hard drive, you can move over and put into that encrypted drive, virtual drive, and it encrypts it. Again, you have to get a good password to protect that. And I think I mentioned this group that last year I had my laptop stolen in Barcelona, Spain, and I had a lot of private, sensitive information on it. It was all encrypted. As far as I know, I haven't seen any consequences of them getting into it. What they probably wound up doing was reformatting the disk drives and selling the computer. So it's very, really very worthwhile doing this. Cryptainer does the same thing essentially as TrueCrypt, and it's a for sale product. 7-Zip is free, and it also does encryption, but it provides a zip file, which is very handy to send to somebody. CryptoForge is another one which is for sale. Any of these are really quite good products. Now on to 37. Device drivers. I must confess I don't look around for updating device drivers on any regular basis. What I've found happens, if I go to, let's say, Service Pack 1, all of a sudden something doesn't work. Typically, the printer won't print or something like that. What has happened with the service pack that you've downloaded, it made that driver you had before obsolete, and now the device driver, which acts between your computer and some other device, just doesn't work. So then you're forced to update the device driver. Updating device drivers is fairly easy. Intel, for example, has a website and a utility that will check your device drivers. It's right there on the link, right here. There's another organization called Slim Drivers, another one called Driver Zone. All of these can be helpful for you to find device drivers. PC World of May of this last year had a very good article on device drivers and why you should pay attention to this. The hardware companies themselves, where you bought your computer, will have websites for updating drivers. HP, Dell, Sony, Toshiba, Apple, they all have them. Yes. No, no. Secunia PSI will not test for device drivers. Yeah, I know. But what usually happens is that one of your devices just doesn't seem to work like it used to. And the first thing to suspect is a device driver. If you're going to do a do this, think a little bit about before you upgrade a device driver and do a do a backup. But there's another
restore point.
You should always make a restore point before you do an update on a device driver, so you can go backwards if you make the situation worse. And if you're using Windows 7, just key at the start button restore point, and it'll talk you through how to do it. It's very simple. Now on slide 39, PDF, of course, is a universal file format for everybody worldwide to read. Adobe Reader is almost certainly the most common device for reading PDF files. PDF originated with Adobe Corporation itself. Adobe Reader 10 is the most, probably the most common reader. I don't like it at all. The reason being is that the hackers are really active with Adobe Reader, searching out weak points and building stuff into PDF files that Adobe Reader can't manage and infecting your machine. As a consequence of this, Adobe seems to have updates to their reader weekly. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but not too much. The reason this is such a target is because that software is so widely used. I use Foxit Reader, which I think is a better product all around, and because not many people use it, it's not the target of hackers. So it's a much safer product to use. There are others like Sumatra, for example, a PDF reader, that are not common, that do the same thing as Adobe Reader. And Adobe Reader has become very bloated as a piece of software. It can be very slow. Foxit, for example, is much faster. And by the way, Google Chrome has a built-in PDF viewer itself. You don't need a plug-in or an add-on with Chrome. It'll display PDF files very nicely. On slide 40, BellArc Advisor is a piece of software that's very useful. This will give you very great detail on your computer. It's free. What I'd suggest is you download it and run it and save the output in a file somewhere. And let me show you why. This is the output from it. It'll tell you about your operating system and the version of it, your processor, that is the CPU, the drives you have in your computer, the system model. This is an HP computer. It tells you the model number, the main circuit board and the main circuit board's serial number, the memory you have in it, and the type of memory. On slide 42, information on what person last logged in, for example, the printers you have and printer drivers, all of the other devices that you have in your computer, slide 43. Software licenses you have on your machine. So if your computer gets blown away and you don't have backup and you can't remember the software you loaded on your computer, if you have a copy of this, you know exactly the software that you've got. It'll also find all the information on the latest versions of the software and when they were last used and so forth. Lots and lots of detail, most of which you'll never need except if things go horribly wrong. Now, when you uninstall something with Windows Uninstaller, sometimes it doesn't quite work. It just doesn't uninstall it. There are quite a number of uninstall programs available. I think one of the better ones is Revo Uninstaller. It complements the uninstaller from Windows, but it'll go a little further. So if you have a program that you can't just seem to get rid of, try this one and see if it'll uninstall it for you. The antivirus software manufacturers used to be notorious for this. It's improved a lot in the last years, but at one point, for example, both with McAfee and Norton, you couldn't get rid of them. Once you install them, they seem to be there forever. But that's improved. But there are going to be occasions when you have a program you can't seem to get rid of it. Try this. This is a really neat utility. It's called Ditto. All of you are familiar with the procedure where you have an object, you type Control-C on it, you load it into a buffer, you go over to, let's say, a Word file and type Control V and you paste it. So copy and paste, copy and paste. But you can only do one object at a time. With Ditto, you can do thousands if you want. And what you do is type Control C, and it loads it into essentially an endless buffer, not quite, but for all practical purposes, an endless buffer. And if you type Control, there's the key which has the tilde on it, there's a little mark below it that looks like kind of like a period. So if you type Control that, you see this buffer, and here are all the things that I did a Control C with earlier. So this is just a piece of text. This is a image. This is a piece of text, an image. And if you then, let's say I had a Word file open, and I wanted to paste that image in it, which I loaded in the buffer four loads ago, you just double-click on it and it pops it in. So you can go down to something you did 2 weeks ago, like this piece of text, double-click on it, and it pops it in. So
does that work for a table where you want to add additional cells?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can't create, this won't create the cell in the table,
no,
but if you want to populate it, if you want to populate with data from a table, yeah, you can highlight the rows in the table, click, and they'll populate it.
Okay, so what was that Control C what?
It's, let me close this.
Let's try
it. It's called Ditto, and it's Control backward comma. It's under this. It's on the same key as the tilde.
The backquote. Backquote.
Backquote. Yeah. On my computer, it sits right above the tab key, and it's the same key as the tilde, the little squiggle thing. I don't know why they picked that. Nobody knows what that character is, or almost nobody. Yeah.
So this saves the content of the pad or whatever you call it.
Right, it does. Yeah. Yeah, and no, it saves them, right. It writes it to the disk. And I don't know what the upper limit is, but it's hundreds or thousands. In practice, I find that maybe 10, 12, 15 is about all I can remember that I ever did before. So that's about it. But it's extremely handy if you have a whole bunch of cut and paste, cut and paste, cut and paste. It just streamlines that whole process. Here I just had an example of what I showed you in lifetime. Here's a these are images of photographs. This is text, images of photos, and so on and so forth. So any object that you can put into your buffer on Windows, you can do into here. And there are quite a... Pardon?
That's clearable.
Yes, you can. You can clear it out. There's a number of options available. You have to poke around with it a little bit and play with it. But it's well worth the money since it's free. It works great. PC Decrapifier is a very useful tool if you get a new computer. 48, slide 48. Thank you so much. With just one exception that I know of, when you buy a new machine, it comes with all kinds of freeware and sample try this stuff. And more often than not, this stuff is loaded into your start menu, and it's a bloody nuisance. The only exception to this is, I know with the Sony's Veo, you can get what's called Fresh Start. They load no crapware on there at all. They don't load anything but the operating system, which means if you buy a Microsoft Office from them, they won't load it. You have to load it. They load nothing but the operating system. But it's clean. You have none of this garbage that the other manufacturers put on there. But not everybody's going to buy this brand of computer. So if you're going to get Dell or HP or Toshiba, think about using PC Decrapifier and getting rid of that stuff. It's very handy and easy to use. Keyboard shortcuts with Windows 7. There are whole bunches of them. I'd suggest... at least what I've done is I made a table of about 24 of them, and that's about all I can remember at my age anymore anyway. And after you practice with them for a while, they become kind of second nature to you. It'll markedly improve your productivity by using keyboard shortcuts. And there's a whole list here from Microsoft, Windows Secrets, which is a web publication, has a list of them. And don't forget, as I say, with the Alt-Tab, because this is called the arrow. You can cycle through all the things you have open on your computer and pop into any particular one you want. I mean, that's a shortcut that's really worth knowing about, isn't it? This is just the desktop. And here now I'm back to the presentation. So that's the keyboard shortcut of the Windows key plus the Tab key. That's just one example of a lot of these things that are really helpful. Now, slide 50. The character map is very useful if you are doing word processing or using Excel tables for putting in special characters. If you're just writing plain old prose, forget about it. I'm a chemist, so I have all kinds of stuff that I write about that's not in a normal character set. And here are instructions how to pin this to the taskbar. Are you familiar with the taskbar in Windows 7? Everybody have a notice? Know what that is? Okay. But you can pin this character map to the taskbar and it becomes very useful. And this is what it looks like. This is one screenshot of it with a number of special characters. But you can include dozens of fonts, all kinds of special characters and so forth, and paste them very easily. The trouble with this is this isn't indexed, really. You have to kind of hunt and search and peck to find them. After you use a number of them commonly, you know where they are, but it's sometimes a little clumsy to find them. But this is a whole lot easier than any other way to deal with all the special character stuff. Slide 52, reliability monitor. This can be helpful when you have reoccurrences of something that crashes or hangs up or quits. You may call customer service and you say, my widget is doing a widhoozit, and then they'll say, well, how often does it do it? And you say, I don't know, it happens every once in a while. The reliability monitor will tell you exactly what's going wrong and when, so you can say, on August 12th, Microsoft Word crashed. On this computer, I have a problem, not this one, another one, a problem with Microsoft Outlook quitting. And all these red dots are the days that it quit. So I can tell on what day Microsoft Office Outlook, rather, failed. So it's a good way to keep track of, in a quantitative way, of when things go wrong. So you don't just tell somebody or yourself, yeah, this thing is quitting more often than it used to. You can now look and know exactly how often it's quitting. On slide 54, problem steps recorder. This is very useful when you have a problem that's reproducible. Now, oftentimes, difficulties you have aren't reproducible, and they become very hard to track down and fix. And it's just a real problem. But there are times when something is crashing or going away or screwing up, and it does it every single time you use that application. Now you're in business to really document it. What you do is start this recorder. You go to start, key, psr.exe, and then you left-click on an icon that says start record. And from that point on, everything you do is recorded. So then you run the application that's misbehaving, and you can add comments as you're going along. You know, you can say, I entered my mother's maiden name and then this happened, or whatever it is that you feel can contribute to information on the problem. And when you're done and the thing has failed again as usual, you click stop record, and then it creates a zip file containing the record of all that stuff you just did. Then you can send that zip file off to your favorite friend who's going to help you fix the problem. And now it is well documented. And this can be very useful for a tech representative who's trying to fix your problem, rather than you sitting there trying to explain to them what's going on. So this is a very useful tool for documenting and leading to a solution of problems. And this is described in Maximum PC in this current issue. There's a nice discussion of it. Now, with along with problems, sometimes, many times, it's very useful to have somebody who really knows what they're doing have a remote access to your computer. Windows 7 comes with remote or Windows Remote Desktop Connection. It's almost on all versions now of Windows. I think the basic one it's not, but you can read about how to invoke it. It's very simple. You can give somebody permission to come onto your machine and work on it. Show My PC is another one that's very commonly used. Log Me In is another one, and there are others. In fact, if you go to Wikipedia, there's one article that shows 40-plus different ways for you to have remote access to a computer. So all of these tools like this can be very handy at times. My son, who's really very good at all this stuff, helps me when I really get stuck. He calls in from Florida, gets onto my machine. I go have lunch, and he fixes it.
Lawrence,
yeah.
This might be your next slide, but you can also use remote access when you're traveling
yeah.
to get back to your computer and work as if you were sitting at your own desk.
That's correct. Of course, you have to leave your computer on, but that's true. And it wasn't on my next slide. 56. Okay, we're at slide 56, and just a few more minutes to go, don't we? There are all kinds of tips. Well, resource monitor I wanted to mention. This locates frozen processes. Have you ever had a program that runs and it just sort of quits on you, and the whole machine is locked up, and you don't know what am I going to do? And you wind up either unplugging the damn computer or pushing the reset button? I have a tool for you. If you go to the Start button, key Resmon, and then click on resmon.exe, this locates frozen processes, and they're highlighted in red. Then you right-click on that red process. I can't duplicate it because I don't have a frozen process, but this is how you do it. You right-click on that frozen process that this software has detected. Now, if there are more than two processes displayed, the one lowest on the list is the one that's frozen. Then you check a box that says end process and go, and it'll kill that process. More often than not, that'll free up your computer. It cleans out the problem. So I would try this before you unplug the computer. And it's very easy to do. It won't do any harm. I mean, the worst thing that'll happen is if you are killing a Word file, for example, you might lose some data that you least put in. But at least you're back up and running, and you're not doing the damage you might do if you unplug the computer. So this can be very useful. Windows Calculator, it's not what it used to be. This is what the old Windows Calculator looked like, but the new one does this, plus it has a scientific calculator. It's all bundled into the same one. It has a programmer calculator, and it has a statistics calculator. It's very good. There are probably better ones out there, but this is very good, and I think for most people, this will really do the trick.
How did you invoke the different forms?
There's a little window on the calculator when it first comes up that you push which mode, and you have the option. Now, here's a list of 92 free utilities. Here's a list of 85 Windows tips, all kinds of stuff, a lot more than I have time to talk about. One word of caution on any and all of these things. Before you download any of them, do a search on Google or Bing or whatever your favorite website is for that program and see what people are saying about it. Because sometimes there are nasty people out there who will put up a utility who will say, this does this, and it'll wind up doing something very, very different to your machine. So be cautious about any of these things you download. I also keep track of everything I download. I have a table of them, what it is, where I got it, the date, and so forth. That way I know what's going on with my machine. If I have a problem, I can go back and see what's going on. Gadgets. There are all kinds of gadgets available. These are just three I wanted to mention. System Monitor, which is this one down here. I'm on slide 61. It shows you the amount of CPU that's being used or the amount of RAM on your machine. The network meter shows the activity on your home network, whether it's overloaded or not. This one called Margu Notebook Info 2, what an awful name. is very helpful on laptops because it'll show the wireless network you're connected to and the strength of the signal. It shows your battery, what its charge is on it, and it shows, not terribly useful, but how long your computer has been up. And there are other things with you can list and show here. I find this particularly useful on the laptop. Did I go backwards? I did. I'm on slide 62. I like to listen to music, and I just mentioned these radio players. BBC has one, which looks like this. 11 different BBC radio stations. BBC Overseas service for news is outstanding. They're not just talking heads. iClassical radio player has 16 different classical radio stations. As you can tell, I like classical music. This one, which is kind of a clunky-looking icon that sits on your desktop, has various genre of music. So these are all freely available, and you can get them from these links. This is a particularly useful gadget for Outlook. How many people use Outlook here? A few people, yeah, a fair number. You can get it from this website. What it does is it shows this little pane on your desktop, and it shows you the most recent 5 appointments you have in your calendar. So you don't even have to open up Outlook. They're just listed here. So, yeah, this one will go pick up my car at the car repair place. I had 2 courses for Ollie. Somebody's supposed to phone me. I'm supposed to give a presentation and so on. So it just picks the top 5. You can get a whole bunch of gadgets from Microsoft. This is a safe site to get them. Okay, time to wake up. Time for cookies. That's all.